Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to episode 52 of the Building Better Leaders podcast. We are so happy to be recording this episode because it's 52 episodes and there's 52 weeks in the year. And when John and I originally set out to record a leadership podcast, we gave ourselves the goal, the mini goal, if you like, didn't we, John? Of just recording them for a year and seeing where we ended up to. So this is a momentous milestone for us. So well done you.
Well, well done you, Rachel. And thanks for putting up with me. And I mean, we've changed it a little bit, haven't we, over the course of the time when we started it. We've had some absolutely fantastic guests on. And we have sort of smattered that every 3 weeks, every 4 weeks with a summary of those guests and the leadership essentials that those guests talked about. And we've also created a fictional organization that we still haven't given it a name. And we've really tried to sort of play out those leadership essentials in that fictional organization. I mean, I've loved it. I really enjoyed it. We started this in COVID, didn't we? Nobody knew what was really happening. So it was a great thing to do. And we've got some different ideas about how we might change this going forward and improve it. And maybe we go for some little sort of bite-sized 15-minute podcasts that we concentrate on one subject with, so that they're easy for people to consume. Whereas we'll still keep the interviews, and they tend to be around about an hour and 15 minutes.
So for 2022, there will be a new look, a new format, Building Better Leaders podcast. We would absolutely welcome any feedback from any of our listeners. So please do get in touch with us on leaders@scaffoldcoaching.com. But before we do that, and you listen to the one after this, 52 is a momentous podcast number, like we said. So we thought we'd shake things up a bit for this episode and do it as a bit of a pre-Christmas. It's our Christmas party in a podcast, John, if you like. We thought we'd shake up the format for this podcast. And really, you know, John and I have talked about leadership for over a year now on this podcast, and we've had some phenomenal guests like John said that we've interviewed, but we haven't really said that much about each other and our leadership journeys, but we've never really properly introduced ourselves to our listeners. So we thought we would actually just do a little bit of a Q&A on our backstories for the first bit of this podcast, so you can just get to know John and myself a little bit better. I know it's always nice when you do bring us in for webinars or for coaching sessions that you do know somebody's backstory. So we thought that would be quite useful. And then we were just going to reflect on what we've learned through doing all of these podcasts and what these leadership essentials have meant to us.
Yeah. We've looked at it differently, haven't we, in how we would summarize, if you like, those leadership essentials. So I'm going to ask you a few questions about how you've sort of come about it, and then we'll do vice versa, and you can ask me and see if how that feels to the listener, really, because I actually will be really interested to see what people think about these leadership essentials and how they might have reflected on them over the year. So yeah, it'd be interesting stuff.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, like you said, we started this podcast in COVID, but you know, one of our values that we both each share, we do have some different values, don't we? But we do have some shared values. One of them is continuous learning. And from doing this podcast, I just want to thank you, because I've learned a lot from just discussing these things. I've learned a lot from our guests. I've learned a lot from looking at leadership in a different way. So I think this exercise and this podcast is just reflecting on our learnings. And hopefully if we can share our understanding of that with our listeners, it will cement their learning in a different way.
Yeah, very much so. So where are we gonna start then, Rachel?
I'm gonna start with you. I don't want to go first. So, John, I don't even know how old exactly you are, where you grew up. I know a little bit about your childhood, but not much. Give me the school age John story in About 3 minutes.
Right. Okay. Well, so this is a very quick potted history of John Tattersall. So I was born in March 1965. So I am now currently 56 years old. I have a younger brother, bit of an age gap between Chris and me. He's 8 years younger than me. I've got two children. He's got two children. Both our parents have now passed away. I had a really, really, really happy childhood. My dad worked as an electrical fitter at Skelton Grange Power Station in Leeds. He had that as a, that was his career. Mum did all sorts of different jobs. She's been a secretary. She'd been a shopkeeper. She was just a fabulous mum. Yeah, just a really, really happy childhood, really. Did I like going to school? Yeah, I did like going to school. Really loved waiting for playtime. I was a little bit of a starer out of the window, you know, mind running. I'm thinking about playing football in half an hour, not really listening to what I'm probably supposed to be listening to. I was like fiercely competitive, and I've been fiercely competitive with myself, I think, to my detriment in some respects, because I've wanted to almost be perfect. And it's like that strive for perfectionism. One of the things that I've always talked about being school age, and the thing that I really remember more than anything else, particularly when I was like 5, 6, we used to do spelling tests, and I don't know whether I'm like slightly dyslexic or not. I could be, but I couldn't tell you for certain whether I was. In 1970, dyslexia wasn't really a thing, I don't think. I mean, I'm not saying that I should know about it when I was 5, but I don't think it was particularly a thing. And we used to do spelling tests. You remember doing spelling tests, math tests and all that. And the thing I can remember most, Rachel, about it is the CMEs at the, you know, that's written in red pen at the bottom of the test, because I've got like 2 out of 10 correct in my spelling. And to the point where I think I became really quite sort of, you know, a bit of a cry for help, really. And I think that's where the rebellious streak came out. So if I couldn't get it right, then I'd just basically be naughty. So does that explain my childhood at school for you in 3 minutes?
Yes. I'm not surprised, John, but I didn't, you know, I think what you just shared there and what it's really nice is that rebellion always comes from a place of, when you understand the story, there's a story of compassion there not understanding. And I think teachers listening to this can of course correct me, but I think school have got a lot better understanding of that. It's not so black and white either not trying or you're not capable, and every child is different and has different levels of potential. So I think things have moved on, and I am very joyous about that, but I totally get where that comes from.
Well, I think there was an element of pride as well in me, that I wanted to go home and show mum and dad that I'd done a good job and that I'd got it right and I'd done really well. And that's I'm saying, it's like really, really, it's just a very competitive edge you have. But I think sometimes it can be detrimental to people who view it the way that I do, because you're almost trying to be impossibly imperfect, and nobody's like that.
No.
So you create your own pressure. And often that's not helpful.
No, exactly.
So, I think that's the key learning, really, from being a very, very young child at school.
And John, post-school then, so did you go to university? What was your first job?
Right, so we move on a few years, and I've got to the end of my O-levels. I worked really, really, really hard to get my O-levels, like ridiculously hard. I studied so diligently, because I wasn't one of these kids who could just basically pick up a book the night before and be able to rock up to the exam and know that I'd do well. I knew that I'd had to work really, really hard for it. And I did. And I think I went into sixth form to do A-levels. And I'd already decided that I'd achieved academia. by having got my O levels, which meant I was very rebellious in the sixth form. And I remember the sixth form tutor saying, the best thing that you can do, John, is leave, because you're not going to get your A levels, are you, behaving the way that you're behaving? And I was like, I was like really rebellious. I'd just like skip school, go into white school in Harrogate Granby High School. It was a very, very big school, met loads of kids there. It was like over 2,500 kids at it. And so we'd just go off into Harrogate and go to the pub and try and get into the pub when we shouldn't be able to get into the pub. And then we'd go play squash or we'd go play football or whatever. And so basically I said, you better leave. The mum said, right, well, you need to get a secure job. So I got a job in a bank. Worked in banking for like 20 odd years in total. I worked in two banks, worked in Yorkshire Bank and worked in Bank of Scotland Corporate. Never really liked it, but I made a decent career out of it. I was all right at it. Didn't want particularly bothered. I was more bothered about the social side of it, probably a little bit too much. And then on the back of that, really, I reflected on how many good leaders I'd worked for and how many not so good leaders I'd worked for. And I'd learned a lot from both. You do learn both sides, don't you? And I was like, what is my purpose? What's my reason why? What do I want to actually achieve? What do I want to do? And it was more about being able to give back my experiences and make it easier for people to sort of traverse their careers by having some idea of how you should be as a follower of a leader, how you should be treating your followers as a leader, how you should work with your teams. What were the things that I took from it in terms of my own leadership, my own development, and how could I help people in teams? And that's, you know, so it's 11 years ago I started that now. So
when you were at, was it Royal Bank of Scotland?
No, Bank of Scotland.
So when you were at Bank of Scotland, did they invest a lot in leadership training, like at that appetite?
No, not at all. And we're talking 2006 when I went there. So, you know, that's relatively recent. In the last 15 years, isn't it? You know, and you're like, I can't really, when I think about it, no, very little. In fact, Yorkshire Bank were a small regional bank, really. Yes, they spread out across the country, but they had very little in way of a branch network by comparison to a NatWest, to a Royal Bank of Scotland, to a Lloyds, to a Midland, it later became HSBC. But the one thing that Yorkshire Bank did really, really well was train its people. It was really good at that. But less so, I felt, in Bank of Scotland, and some very autocratic leadership styles in both banks, but specifically in Bank of Scotland, very autocratic. It's a lot about power. It's a lot about money, a lot about winning at whatever cost.
I find it interesting that not going on that, or not having that insight into it, but you still found it yourself. And I just think that's obviously a lot of work done on asking yourself a lot of questions to find leadership coaching in a way that's not a path that's been paved out for you.
And a lot of uncomfortable answers, I think, Rachel, because you have to look at yourself as well and think, you know, have I been behaving like a dick? Yeah. You know, I mean, it's not one way. You know, what have I done that's contributed myself to, you know, things that haven't worked out well in your life? You have to be able to look at that through a bit of introspection, I think, and recognize that you've made mistakes as well, because we all do. But I think when you grow up and that's why I'm sort of couching it in terms of how I grew up, was like I was really competitive with myself. So how willing was I in my younger years to look at myself and say, well, actually, no, a lot of this is down to you, not everybody else. you know, not sort of playing the victim card, really.
No, thank you for sharing that. So just before we close out on that then, and on that line of questioning, before you got into the coaching aspect, what was your career high point and what was your low point? It's like best experience in banking and worst experience without confidentialities.
It's a funny one, this. When I left Bank of Scotland, it had been taken over by Lloyds. You remember the end of 2008, the banking crisis. We were Halifax Bank of Scotland, the major group, and they got taken out by Lloyds, and everybody had to reapply for their own jobs. And I made it pretty clear in my rebellious streak that I wasn't going to put an awful lot of effort into doing that, because I was pretty much like, I've decided I'm going to go anyway. But my career highlight was being told that I wasn't any shade of grey, and that's what they were looking for. They were looking for people who were just shades of grey, and I wasn't any shade of grey. I was too colourful, and that is my career high point, as in, I think that just about summed me up at the time. It's like, no, right, I am definitely not what you're looking for. And so on that basis, I'm going to go and do my own thing. So that was my highlight. My low point in my career. There's been a lot of low points. I think the most low point, the lowest point, was applying for a job and finding out later on that there'd been clandestine meetings between the person who actually got the job and that I'd had one interview. So basically, I was rocking up to an interview for a job that I were never going to get because it had already been decided. And so I think there's quite a bit of impetus behind how unfair that is. I know life's not fair, but that's not playing the game. And I think that was quite a catalyst for me going on to do the work that we've done.
Yeah, well, very good. Thank you very much. And
your turn.
Okay, go on then. I can't ask you questions further. Go on then, ask me some questions.
So, Rachel, tell us about your childhood in 3 minutes.
I am the oldest of four children, grew up in Doncaster, which regular podcast listeners will know. Have talked a little bit about my mum on some of the podcasts, so I won't go into that. But at school, I did have a happy childhood, actually, and I really enjoyed primary school. I was lucky enough to go to middle school, you know, before they
did it. Yes, I remember. Yeah. I think my brother was the same. Yeah.
Yeah, I think middle school was a real gift to me because I think they'd already decided at primary school what I was going to be. And because I was a younger kid in the year group, I wasn't that bright. And another person in the class was always the favourite. And when I went to middle school, I kind of found my tribe and my flow, if you like. So I went into high school with a different level of confidence, and I was incredibly shy child, actually, until I was probably about nine. And went back, because I went to middle school, by the time I got to high school, I was a lot more confident.
Can you think of one particular reason as to why that was? Is there like something that happened? Was there an event, or
did it just
become something that happened in that at that time, that age?
You mean the confidence?
Yeah.
I think I learned very early on that teachers quite often aren't right. So when I went to high school, I mean, I was probably, I knew I was bright, and I think I talked on another podcast around my eyesight was very bad. So where I'd been labelled as a bit thick because I couldn't see the board, as soon as I got glasses, a whole level of knowledge opened up to me.
Yeah.
And I suppose, again, you know, I was in set one for most things, except for French, because I'd already missed the boat on that. I've been but you realize you've got to work at the speed of the class. And if you're fast, obviously you do get time to just mess around after. So I think overall I was pretty studious at school. I always did my work, but I was quite rebellious as well. I was quite often in trouble, but only because I had time to be. Do you know what I mean? It was never for anything serious. It was, and I left.
But you were bored a lot of the time in having done the work, and you had time to kill, and you just thought, well, I'll just mess about.
Or a lot of classes. You know, I remember being in history, and they were like, I was so good at history, and I was really interested in it. But then they'd make me, like, teach the people that were struggling. So I'd have to, like, help other people, and I'd be like, are you serious? And, you know, you're
teaching. Without paying you? I'm not getting paid for this. I'm not doing this voluntarily.
Yeah. I really enjoyed school, and I was very lucky that I had a group of about six friends, and we were all very bright. And we were all, I mean, in Doncaster in the 90s, to have, like, six friends that were in the same class for most things, and we all left with, like, A's, and everybody went to either a Russell Group university or an exceptionally good university. We were very competitive with each other, but in a supportive way. So it was a really, it was just a different environment, you know. It was, like, very supportive in a lot of ways in terms of my peer group, where it was a healthy competition. But I think education's probably changed a lot since then, and maybe I would have flourished in a different, or been a bit more constructive in a different way if they'd have understood me a bit more. But I don't know. I mean, I'm very, very proud of my results. My mum was also diagnosed with cancer when I was in year 10, and she really wanted me to do well. So I think a lot of my impetus was to make her happy.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed studying for my exams because I knew it would make her happy.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting? That's a, it becomes an intrinsic goal, isn't it? But it starts out as a sort of extrinsic.
I remember at one point, this will make you laugh. I remember thinking, you know, I am, actually, this is interesting on the motivation. I remember being put in set two for maths when I was in year eight. And I remember going into the set two class and being like, I'm loads cleverer than these people. This is ridiculous. So I made my mum go up to the school and tell them to put me in set one. And they argued against it, but she wouldn't leave until they did. And then we did the SATs tests, and I scored the highest in the year out of the girls. But they said they were going to kick me out if I hadn't have scored an exceptional because I didn't try in class. But I got that result. And so when I'd been, like, estimated my grades, they'd estimated me all at B's and C's when we were in, like, you know, going into year 10. And I was like, how dare you decide what you think I'm capable of? And I think even at that age, at 14, it outraged me that these teachers that had probably at best got a 2-2 at university were able to estimate what they thought your potential was.
Mm.
And it outraged me. So I thought, nana's to you, I'm going to try really hard just to piss you off.
Yeah.
So that was my first motivation. Then my second bit of motivation was, I think, for doing the GCSEs, my mum and dad had said they'd give me, like, a fiver for a C, 10 quid for a B, 15 for an A, or 20 for an A star or something. And then obviously I realised how much it meant to my mum. So I ended up leaving school with, like, 7 A stars and 3 A's and then a C in French. And that C in French was because I didn't do the, they only put me in for the exam that, you could, the highest you could get was a C. And in the end, my mum and dad were like, we can't even bloody afford to pay you because you're great. You know, I didn't get any money because they
still didn't get the money.
But I did, by then the motivation wasn't for that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And every single teacher was like, we knew you could do it. I was like, but how, when none of you estimated me more than a B?
retrospectively, they were like, oh, well, we knew you'd do it.
But I was in the paper. They wanted me to be photographed, blah, blah, blah. And then I went to a different sixth form, and I really, really enjoyed sixth form. Straight A's at sixth form, B in general studies, but A in maths and history and economics, loved it.
So this will make you laugh. I mean, most of the people who've listened to all these podcasts will know where you've worked your career, because you tell people, don't you? And I think the reason you tell people is that there are a lot of really good lessons coming out of your experiences at work. What's your highlight? What was the thing that you were most proud of And what was the thing that you were like least proud of? What was the thing? What was like your low point?
I think, no, before I answer that, I think the reason I talk about my work a lot is, unlike you, and this was interesting, so I didn't know this about you, I've been very lucky for all of my career, for every organisation that I've worked for, to really invest in leadership development. Mm-hmm. And so I'd been exposed to a lot of this stuff from quite a young age, and I found it really inspiring. Mm. And it was a very different kind of teaching and learning experience to what I'd had at school, in that there's no pass or fail, right or wrong. So I think it's even more like I'm in more awe of you because you found it not by being shown it, whereas I was very lucky to, I think I can almost see how I fell into this path because the organisations that I worked for took me there.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you know, maybe you're doing yourself down a little bit, really, Rach, because you did go to university and you've got a degree in psychology, and you know, you had to go and do that for yourself. That wasn't granted to you without the effort.
Well, that leads us to the high and low nicely, I suppose. So high point, let me see. My high point, probably, I've had loads of high points. There's too many, but the one standout one is probably getting a job at British Airways. So I've been working for a company called JC Deco, which is a phenomenal company as well. And they really, really did look after their people. That was working in marketing. And I was like, I'm just this working class kid who has to work in sales because I cannot afford to do an internship. Like, I just seen all these jobs in advertising agent, the things that I wanted to do, I just had no way of getting there. Like, your living expenses are £1,500 a month, and it was just catastrophic, like a way to live. And then I saw this advertisement in one of the Marketing Week newspapers that British Airways World Cargo were looking for a marketing exec. And my very good friend Hillary, who worked across from me in at JC Deco, put it in front of me and said, you should apply for this. And then so she helped me apply for it. And we put a lot of time and effort into the application. You know, I made it all very, you know, suave and stuff. And then I got an interview, and then I got the job, and 200 people had applied for that job and 12 had been interviewed, and I got it, and I was just so pleased. And also, I think doing what I do even now, and like, it's not a company or a job that anybody in your family could relate to, but working to British Airways, my dad was proud, my aunties were proud. And it was the World Cargo division, but it was a way in to a company that at that time, you know, there was the staff travel, the training, the like, everything was like, the office was phenomenal. And then I ended up getting another job and moving on to the passenger side of the business. And it was my dream job. And I just bloody loved it. Like, I loved everything about it. And it was just such a privilege. Yeah. It was getting that job, I think. And then the low point.
Some achievement.
Yeah. And, you know, I think.
How old were you then?
I was 25 when I got the job, and I only worked there for 3 years. And the reason, I don't mind sharing this, the reason I left was the crash of 2008, 2009 that you mentioned. They had redundancies go in, and it's very trade union protected. So, I mean, nobody thought for a second I would go and take it. And I loved that job, and I absolutely wanted to stay. Mm-hmm. But what I didn't tell many people at that time was that work moving to London, been quite poor from a poor background. I was in a crippling amount of credit card debt. I just could not afford to have been in London that young on a salary less like 15 grand than 20. I think by the time I left BA, I was on like 32 grand, which was a decent amount of money then. Mm. But what it hadn't paid, I couldn't pay off the debt from being on 15 grand for 2 years.
Yeah, you hadn't earned that for long enough.
Oh my God. And the amount of debt, it was causing me health problems, like how, like I was having to pay like minimum repayments of like £500 a month.
Yeah.
Like, and then this amount of money for the, I just said, look, what would it be? And I'd only been there 3 years and it was enough to pay off my credit card debt.
Right.
And well, I was actually technically on an IVA at that point, which is near enough bankruptcy. So that's the only reason I left. So that was probably a bit of a low point, actually, been that much debt and having to leave. And then probably the real low point of my career was working at Qantas on secondment. And Anne, who we had on the podcast about talking about redundancy, we'd both worked for this same individual, this leader. And the bullying that, like, I was bullied in, we were all bullied in that job if you worked for that individual, how it made me feel, and more importantly, on reflection, how I then treated other people was horrendous. Like, I'm not proud of myself.
As in the learnt behaviour of that person.
Yeah,
when you're subject to it.
Yeah, yeah.
You think, right, well, okay, well, this is clearly the way that I need to behave myself in order to get forward.
Oh my God. Like, in some ways, like, I didn't, you know, you're thinking, like, I'm 20 odd years old, 28, 29. I can't be getting bullied in a massive airline, like, at this level. And the job was phenomenal. Like, I had the things I was going on were amazing, and the job was everything I wanted, but I hated it because I used to feel sick every day going into work. And it affected my relationship. The relationship that was in at that time, I was a cow to him, and he was obviously horrendous to me as well, but that was massively impacted by what, do you know what I mean? You think, I was a bitch. And also, I think when you try and second, I wasn't mature enough then to understand that it was bullying and to leave it. I tried to then second guess, and then you try and make somebody like you. And that, oh my God. And then I think about what I was like as a leader for probably the 5 years after that, there were still repercussions. Like, my subsequent leaders had to undo the effects of that year of sustained bullying. And I can't talk about it as, oh God, it was just bullying, because it was bystander effect as well. It was watching it happen to other people, and then having to deal with that guilt yourself, and then you not becoming a very nice person.
It's interesting how we look back on it, isn't it?
Yeah.
On reflection, but at the time it seems like it's the thing to do. But I always think there's nothing. I mean, we both experienced the same thing in, like, feeling like sick going to work. And I think that is the worst feeling ever. It's that Sunday afternoon feeling that Monday's going to be here very quickly. And you're really, really hating the fact that you're going to have to go to work.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think, though, at that period of time, I think everybody, I later learned at the very end of that we were all feeling the same way. But we were that driven, divided. Nobody, you were fearful to talk to other people.
Yeah.
And I think
so there was a lot of artificial harmony then.
Oh my goodness. And I think that's why I really maybe fell into coaching as well, about the talking through problems and issues. And yeah. I mean, I still don't know. I think there's some things you can't fix, though, because I look back on that period of my life now with compassion, and there was nothing I could have done to have made that situation better, because I didn't have the power.
Yeah.
But what I should have done is got myself out of that situation. Yeah. I got myself out of it. I went and got a job and met a lovely lot of people to work with. But again, I was bitched to some of those people. But yeah, I think it has effects for years.
Definitely. So so I think you've sort of alluded to it, really. For people who are going to work and absolutely hate it. Of course, there's always a trade-off, because you've got to earn a living. And, you know, we tend to live beyond the means that we bring in. What's your advice to somebody? What do they do? Where do they go with that?
I wish I'd have known this at the time, but I think the first thing when you are hating your job that you've got to do is find something outside of work that you love to reconnect with. Because when you're hating your job and you've been bullied, or you're having a horrible time with deadlines you will never be able to achieve, work becomes your focus, because you think if you can just get through things, and then that starts to impact your other relationships because you're unhappy. So it's the hardest thing to do. But if you can reconnect with the things that you like the most, You will find the passion again, and through that you will find the resilience and the strength to apply for the next job. Because it's awful, isn't it, trying to apply and look for a new job when you feel like shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've got no confidence. And I think just reconnecting with anything, a hobby or an activity with a loved one, don't let work become everything. And, yes. And that's my first advice. And my second advice, and in a, this is going to be controversial because I did just say I wish I'd left that job sooner. But actually, there's a bit of me that also wishes I'd have ridden it out, because I was in such a rush in my 20s. You know, I always wanted the next thing. You know, I was very hedonistic. I wanted the next thing. I wanted the bigger promotion. I wanted to be a head of, you know, a department before I'd even learned how to do the work. Do you know what I mean? I wish I'd been a bit more patient. And one of my friends was in the same company, and we're still friends. And the second thing I wish I would have learned and realised is that the bad leaders and the bullying leaders are always weeded out. We thought that it, from where I was sat, it looked like nobody noticed above, and that this behaviour had been ignored, and it wasn't. It just took a year to get the required evidence together. It took 2 years, it did take a while. But I wish I'd just held out a little bit longer, because bad leaders don't last. And it will get better, you know. A bad leader will always be moved on. That's the thing, isn't it? Nothing's forever. Either you will move on and you will find the resilience to move on and the confidence to move on, or they will get found out and somebody will replace them.
Yeah, but as in most, a lot of things in life, it doesn't happen fast enough, does it, for us?
No.
We're in a rush for it to...
And that's personal. Move
on and it to be fixed.
So some people don't mind the waiting game, or they have the internal resilience or the big enough why. Others want everything yesterday, and I was in that camp. I moved on. But to my detriment sometimes, because I didn't work back in the airline industry after that, and I wish I had a few more years under my... I wish I'd enjoyed it a bit longer.
Very good. So that's you and me and all our backstories. People will be raising their eyebrows now, won't they, on my days. So what about our guests then that we've had over the past 12 months and the sort of the how we've reflected on what they've had to say, on the great conversations that we've had? Shall I go first with the way that I was looking at it, and then let people listen to the way that you're looking at it and see if they can draw any sort of any sort of insight from that? So I was thinking about it in two separate ways, really, as in terms of being better at leadership, being a better leader. There's two aspects of it for me. So there's the what do I do for myself if I am that leader? And how do I show up for other people? And then what do I do for my team? And they do mesh, I think, quite a lot. And I think a lot of the leadership essentials that we've got over the 52 podcasts that we've done do mesh. But I did sort of draw this idea that it's what can you do for yourself? So things like you could be more curious rather than having what you think are all the answers. And if you had made some assumptions, and we all do, then have you recognized that you've made some assumptions, and have you tested them? Or did you just run along with that idea? So these are sort of things that you could do for yourself. You can be more self-aware. So when I was saying earlier on about it wasn't just the people that I were working for, and you've said the same thing, you know, we've behaved in a way that's not great as leaders in the jobs that we've done before. I think the greatest challenge for you and me doing what we do is living the value of what we do and what we're coaching, because we can be great teachers and great coaches, but do we demonstrate all the behaviors? And it's really, really difficult. I think, when you're living that in this world all the time of like, and it's back to this sort of perfection street. How good can you be as a leader when you're teaching this stuff and when you're coaching this stuff? So that's the one side of it. And then the other side of it is like to think about your followers and the people who are under your leadership, and how do you behave to them? Are the things that you're asking them to do that you're not really role modeling yourself? So are you tripping yourself up in front of your people because they go, oh yeah, well, he tells us to do all this, but he doesn't do that, you know, and I've got loads of examples here why that I can show. And so that's how I've sort of looked at the leadership essentials, just pretty much like, what can you do for yourself, but what can you do for your people? And have you got any conflicts, if you like, in your leadership style that make you sort of inauthentic, I suppose, as a leader? I always say, think the authenticity around leadership is that you can do both of those things, and you can do them fairly consistently, and your actions match your words, and vice versa.
Absolutely. I really like that. That's that balance between intention versus impact, isn't it? And you can be working on all of this stuff, but if you're not aware of the impact it's having on others, because even when you change from being a bad leader to being a good leader, if you've not told your team about that you are changing something, they're going to start second guessing themselves.
Yeah, and they'll be like, why is this person acting so weirdly?
Is this a trick? You'll be nice. I think I liked what you were saying there around we often encounter people that when they come to leadership training or coaching, they want to work on themselves. But I think you need to do that in tandem with working on others and for your team at the same time to be authentic. So with that in mind, I really like that approach you've taken. What have been your favourite podcasts and podcast guests so far, and to bring those leadership essentials to life?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I'd like to just say thank you to everybody who's come on, because they're giving up their time to do that. And for some people, it's quite a usual thing for them to do. And they're pretty confident that they can add some real value as a guest. And I think for some other people that, you know, there's some people that have done this and they've done it for the very first time. And we're saying to them, look, you'll be absolutely fine. You'll be great. And they're like, oh, I'm really worried that it won't come across right, and what, you know, if I fluff my lines and all that sort of thing. And nobody's done that. You know, nobody's done that, because I think what they're doing is really, they're just telling their story. So once you tell your story, there's no inconsistencies to that. It is what it is. And you can see, if you like, that the pictures in your mind help you tell the story. So I think we've got a little braver as well in terms of asking people who we think that we wouldn't have probably approached at the very beginning of this, would you come along and do a podcast? And we've been very, very fortunate, I think, in the number of positive responses that we've got. So I think that's the first thing to say about it. Really, really grateful for all the people that have come along. And they all have thrown different sort of a different view on it, and in terms of the leadership essentials. There is hardly any of these that are like, certainly not word for word, and there aren't that many of them that are similar. So people have looked at it from their own perspective, and I've been amazed by how many different points of view people have had on the subjects of leadership. You'd have thought that there would just be sort of generic sort of things that got repeated, but really they didn't. So I think lots and lots of really, really good stuff from people. I think the ones that are the real, real leadership focus. So I'm thinking about Philip Grant, who was podcast, I think, number 27. I've known Philip for a long time, so I think it was helpful that I did know him, and I was we were probably able to ask him the right kind of questions, because I sort of knew the sort of story that you and I have just told earlier on in this pod. So I really liked the podcast, the Leadership Essentials that he came out with. A similar thing again. I knew Andy Copsey really well. I worked with Andy for a lot of years. We basically started our careers together. His went in one extremely successful direction. Mine went in a different direction. But Andy was always really, really committed to doing the very, very best thing. And he's quite able to learn, I think, quickly, and see that the path that he was carving out for himself was one that was like really congruent with his values. So I loved interviewing Andy. So those two people, I think, particularly because I knew them very well, thought they were really on point with the leadership stuff. Really enjoyed interviewing Catherine Whitten, which was one of your people that you'd actually worked for. Thought she was really, really, she's held some really, really really good positions, hasn't she, as a chief marketing
ex-Savers
when she was just leaving
Savers and British Airways, like,
yeah, roles. And then we've had Andy Thomas, who talked about better health and nutrition. Really enjoyed listening to Andy, because I think his story was very different, and he's actually produced something that this physical, you know, nutrients and supplements that help people, and they really work, and I'm using them as well now. And so, you know, I really enjoyed that. I thought then we had Positive Psychology with Graham Keane. We had Jonathan Hemus, who talked about crisis, managing crisis. Very, very interesting guys. Even down to Simon Towne, who talked about posture, you know. And as soon as I talk about Simon, my shoulders go down and my sort of back goes back. Because he reminds you that there's a physical side to you working, even if you're working in an office, doesn't he? And what have you. And so, I mean, rather than sort of list off all those leadership essentials from those podcast guests, I just find it really interesting that they've all come from a different angle. I mean, Hertz, Jan Hosted, I didn't think for a minute that he would have done a podcast with us. I bought a book from that he wrote 10 years ago, went on LinkedIn and thought, you know what, I'm going to ask him if he'll come on the podcast. And, you know, sure enough, he was happy to give his time. And, you know, what an amazing hour and a half that was, talking about culture and how that affects, you know, leadership across the world in different organizations, how just different people work from different cultures, just incredible stuff. So, yeah, I feel like I've missed everybody else out that contributed on the pod. But as I said earlier, everybody came from different angles, and I thought it was really, they've been such a joy to do, haven't they?
Yeah, I think what I just took out of that from what you said is there have been some similarities with the Leadership Essentials, but that you are right. There's also a lot of differences. And I think that talks to the authenticity of leadership and finding your own style. And I think by what you've just rattled off then, is there's enough in those 52 episodes and with the breadth of guests we've had to find something that suits you and your leadership style, whether that's the more physical aspects, whether that's the more reputational aspects, the health aspects, the mindset aspects. Everybody's got a different take on it, because there's no one size fits all to this. It's about finding what works for you, and don't try and work on everything all at once, because that's the one sure way you're going to fail.
Sure. I think, you know, I'm thinking about Michael Lawrence, your captain of the Huddersfield Giants. So I think about his perspective working in professional elite sport and what he brought to the podcast. And I think when we never really set out, we were trying to get people from different walks of life. We've had a couple of CEOs, we've had, you know, people who've written books, we've had psychologists, we've had people who've got really, really different careers, people who have had done all sorts of things. I'm thinking about your friend from Partners in Costs.
Oh, Adrian Hawley.
Adrian Hawley. I mean, he's done all sorts of jobs, but I think we have managed somehow to cover pretty much a lot of angles anyway. I can never say that we've covered them all. So it'll be interesting to see who we can get onto the podcast next year and see if we can fill any gaps that might be missing. But I think we have done pretty well without really being, you know, forcing ourselves into finding everybody from all sort of walks of life.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Right, do you want me to do mine?
Yeah, please do, because you've got a very different approach.
I took the approach of reflecting on the last year by looking for the themes, which probably tells you a lot about mine and yours approaches to things. So I am going to leave our listeners on three leadership essentials that I took from looking at our back catalogue. And I took these as overarching themes, but a lot of the podcasts fit into them. And also, I think it's a really nice way to leave the year and to look at leadership in a bit more of a simplistic way and a different way. So the first leadership essential that I took was know your why. And really that this is not a static thing. It's not an exercise that you do once and it's done. And it's like, oh, I know my why now. It's that it's ever evolving. You and I talk a lot about how we're massive fans of Simon Sinek, and his Infinite Game book is one of my top three books ever, I think. Mm-hmm. But I really liked this, a lot of the guests that we had on around knowing your why. So there was Andy Copsey that you talked about. He was episode 50 around. He really talked about taking that time to get to know his team and their whys. And he started by trying to understand what people's values were and their principles, and that values and principles are different from your why, but you can only build up that story when you take the time to sit with people where they are, not where you are. Mm. I really like Jan Eyston that we talked to from SmartWorks around. She talked about why in the realm of vision and creating an inspiring vision, but one that everybody could buy into at a personal level. And certainly the charity SmartWorks talks to that now. You mentioned Adrian. We did a whole podcast on Ikigai and finding your Ikigai, the Japanese method for really finding your why and your purpose in life. And what I really liked about Adrian is he's in his 50s now, and he's probably only just found it, but his entire career has been, you know, a journey from working in a call centre, working as, you know, a bus driver to getting he's now working for these phenomenal charities, yeah. and in the legal profession, where he's helping people that don't have mental capacity. On a personal level, you know, I've been on an endless journey of finding my why, and having Claire Pooley on the podcast around the Sober Curious movement, which was episode 41. For anybody who's thinking about doing Dry January, I implore you to listen to episode 41 before you start it. She really blended in that, you know, the why been for me, a lot of that being the mother and what that means to my to my child. Jonathan Hemus, actually, he spoke about really knowing your own values. And if you're going through a crisis, the best way to succeed is to stick to your own values. You can't stick to your values if you don't know what they are, if they move like this, the changing tides of the sea. So I think that still links to knowing your why. And obviously you've mentioned Graham Keane. I mean, I learned so much from that podcast, episode 45, on the power of positive psychology. I mean, the whole role of positivity and knowing yourself and the impact that you're going to have on leaders, I thought wraps that one up really, really nicely. So that was my, I guess, first one that I took out. My second one, I am going to borrow the words of Kurt Lindley in episode 19, and his second leadership essential was don't be a dick. And I actually think, you know, obviously it's a bit of a leadership essential to just, that's easy to remember. But I think when we think about don't be a dick, I think from a leadership point of view, this has many levels. You know, there's number one, don't be a dick to yourself. You know, if you, I talked before about, you know, feeling ashamed of some of the ways I've like acted in the past, or when you've seen a behavior that you don't feel comfortable with that another leader's doing to somebody else. If you're feeling some angst in yourself or some stress or some unease, don't acknowledge that feeling and do something with it. Don't take it out on your partner. Don't take it out on your team. Don't let stress filter through. You know, don't be a dick. It's not just about how you treat other people. It's about how you recognize how you are in yourself. I thought Philip Grant, episode 21 again, that having a long, hard look in the mirror and really getting to know yourself, your values, your unconscious biases, we all have them. I know inclusivity is a really big topic at the minute, but if you think you don't have a bias or unconscious bias, you are a dick. Like, so know where you are a dick and acknowledge that and spot your weaknesses. I thought Simon Towns, that you mentioned about the posture, was really good on episode 39. And again, I just think don't be a dick to yourself. Like, how are you sitting? How are you treating your body? And we could talk about Andy Thomas, built from Better You, CEO, and making sure you're giving yourself the right supplements. Are you taking your vitamin D in winter? You can't be showing up for your team the best that you need to be if you're not treating your body very well. I suppose we could also put in the Sober Curious one from Claire Pooley, in that I'm certainly a dick when I'm drinking too much, and I am an infinitely better person to work with when I haven't been drinking and I'm not hungover. So I think that would fall under that one for me. So yeah, thank you, Kurt. Episode 19. I loved your don't be a dick one. And last but not least, I think it's a really nice place to finish. Perhaps probably the most profound thing I've learned all year that I hadn't quite reflected on, that has come through at least once a month for me, is that the most important thing in leadership is followership. And we were first introduced to this by yourself, John, in episode 10. And then Catherine Whitten talked about asking yourself, why would somebody follow me? And if you need to ask yourself that question regularly to get to know yourself and think, well, why would somebody follow me? Am I acting in a way that I'd want to follow me at the minute? And is that inspiring? And what could you do to make them want to follow you in a better way? I really liked Andy Thomas's view on episode 35. We talked about him early on Better You, but he talks about treating people on his, you know, in his company as followers, as fellow travellers. And I think that's a really nice way to think about them. And obviously we've mentioned this guy a lot, but Andy Copsey, episode 50, from Leading From Behind, really getting into that mindset of the follower to become a better leader. And I also think we talk about leadership potential in high potential people so much and in the employee review process, but I really wish people would be ranked on how good they are at following, because followership is a real skill. And I think we should teach followership as much as we teach leadership. And I think that starts by leaders asking, why would anybody follow me?
Yeah, making themselves vulnerable enough to look under the cover really and go, right, exactly what is going on? How am I showing up, and why would people follow me? And I think we got that as well. While I'm thinking about it, with Peter Pritchard,
we did. I didn't give him actually, he for me. Sorry, on number two on don't been a dick, when he talked about when they were going to give everybody a £50 gift voucher at Christmas, and yeah, somebody on the exec, but what about the part time people, or what about this? And he's like, don't be a dick, just give everybody the same.
Yeah,
I just thought he was brilliant at that, but he was brilliant on the followership one as well. Yeah, at Pets at Home. That's a great conversation, episode 46.
Yeah.
So they're my reflections on the year and on the podcast. And, you know, again, I just want to reiterate what you said. I've learned a lot from doing these. I think it definitely, there's a lot in there for people to dip in and out of, but as always, we're looking to improve. We'd love some more brilliant guests for next year. So if anybody's got anybody that they're thinking, I'd love for you two to interview, please do drop us a line, or better still, introduce us to them. And we'd be very open to having some different podcast guests on for 2022. But yeah, that, I think that's a nice place to leave it. I hope everybody has a lovely Christmas and a very happy new year. And it's a great time when you are taking some time out to reflect on yourself and where you want to be next. So use the time off wisely for a little bit.
Yeah, I think it is. It's a very good time to look back and reflect on what's happened in the last year and then think, right, okay, what do I want to make different? What do I want to keep the same? What do I want to stop? So that's stop, start, continue. What am I going to do at the end of this year in order to make sure that I'm giving myself the very best chance of making 2022 as good a year as I can? And I think, yeah, that is a good place to leave it, Rachel. Thank you, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. Happy Christmas, and we'll see you in the new year.
See ya. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you've got a lot out of this. If you'd like to read up a bit more on any of the content that you've heard in today's podcast, be sure to check out our website, scaffoldcoaching.com.